Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yes, hello again, everyone. Welcome back to None But the Brave, a part of Evergreen Podcast. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy Flynn McClain. And as we record this episode tonight, it's January 11th. Today would have been Clarence's 80th birthday, and we just really want to take a moment to say that we remember him. He was such a powerful force in my life, and I know in Flynn's life, and I imagine that anyone who's hearing my voice feels the same way. Clarence was just an amazing guy, an amazing musician.
Yeah, he was big in every sense of the word, and big smile, big personality, and of course the big sound of the saxophone just became such a huge part of Bruce's signature sound, and so big.
It's so true, and you think of some of the performances. Of course, the first one that's going to jump to mind is any performance of Jungle Land. But just the force that man was on a concert stage and what he meant symbolically to the fans, he really was, other than Bruce, the face of the E Street Band. Of course, the two of them were on the cover of Born to Run, the most significant album of Bruce's career, and one of probably the most widely viewed covers in the history of rock and roll.
that's a good way of putting it. And Clarence was certainly, well, I mean, I think back to that, to the story in the Carlin book about how if Bruce could fire anyone in the band and have a replacement within 24 hours, except maybe Clarence, and that certainly was the case. And even in the last few years of Clarence's life, Clarence's touring life with Bruce, he may have lost a step or two, but the aura around him never decreased. He was, as you said, he was a force on stage, even if he was just sitting on his stool. And during the last few shows in 2009, there was a spotlight on Clarence. Whether it may not have been visible, but it was certainly there, especially that last night in Buffalo where they recreated that Born to Run album cover shot. And that was always such a beautiful moment.
Yeah, and to take nothing away from Jake, who's done a great job, I'm sure Jake would be the first to admit there is no replacing Clarence Clemons. So,
no, it took a horn section, took five guys to replace Clarence on the next tour.
So we just wanted to say, Clarence, we remember you and we miss you.
Yes, we do.
Another thing we need to discuss tonight, and this was a bit of a shocker on...
Not really.
Well, it depends how you want to view it, but New Year's Eve, I got a call early in the morning with some news. I called you. I said, I just got a call and supposedly the tour is off. I was a bit in shock, and you then checked it out and said, I just heard the same thing. And then we went through the weekend and people came back to work in the new year. And sure enough, there were reports both from people we had heard from and in the media. Unfortunately, it appears that tour 2022 for Bruce and E Street Band is off. By all accounts, they have canceled the European dates that they had in place, which were going to begin in Barcelona. And also, they have apparently released the holds they had for the United States. We can say that the U.S. tour was going to begin in Foxborough on August 2nd. And it's a real, real bummer. And understanding with what's going on, very, very hard, certainly, I think, to tour in Europe right now and cross all those borders, but just so much a bummer. And we all just want Bruce and the band to be back on the stage, and we may have to wait a little bit longer.
Well, we want them on that stage, but we also want them to be healthy. You know, I think we all wanted it just because of the last 2 years have been so difficult for a lot of people. And we wanted to see them up there, but we're just not quite there yet with the dealing with the pandemic. And it's one thing, and we talked about, you know, events are happening, baseball games, football games, and the reality is that, you know, they're going to go on. There are backup quarterbacks, there are backup running backs, there are backup shortstops, and minor leagues full of starting pitchers, but there's no backup for Bruce. There's no backup for Roy or Max or anybody. So, you know, they couldn't risk one of them getting sick and having to, you know, I mean, obviously we want them to be healthy, but at the same time, the shows would get canceled if in that situation. You can't just bring up a guitar tech or a drum tech and say, this is the legendary E Street band, because at that point it would not be.
Here, as we've discussed off air, in the entertainment industry, one of the things that's going on, and I'm dealing with this on a daily basis because I have a film that should have been shot already, there's regular testing going on. And one of the things you're seeing is, we've seen it on Broadway, we're seeing it on a lot of TV and film productions, we're seeing it in some of the sports leagues. If you test people regularly, and that is what's happening on all of these entertainment productions, that positives are going to be there and there's going to be shutdowns. So what Bruce was really had to be looking at here is that you go off to Europe. I assume there would be a testing regimen on our productions. There has to be something called a COVID compliance officer. I believe the same position is being filled on most of the concert tours, and the tests are administered. And as they come back at a certain threshold, if you hit that, the production gets shut down. So it makes it very, very untenable. We are just at a complete loss, really, as to how to handle this. I know several people who shot films, and this was before Omicron that got shut down. And it's really, really difficult to deal with if economically and from a scheduling perspective. And here, when you're dealing with a rock tour, as you were just saying, what happens is key members of the crew, if they have to go into isolation, you literally could have the production unable to do what they need to do. Or even worse, they're sitting in Amsterdam 2 hours before a show, and their COVID compliance officer comes into the room and says to Landau, Max, Gary, and Roy just tested positive. They can't go on stage. It's a massive logistical problem at the moment. And it's easy to understand, certainly, why they got rid of Europe. The U.S. being so far out, it would have been great if we had some kind of hope, and perhaps it still exists. But as I said, as far as we know now, all dates for the year have been removed.
Well, yes, and that's unfortunate, but it's totally understandable. And I guess you can come up with the argument that, well, it's X number of months in advance, we don't know what's going to happen. And it's true of the last two summers, the summer of 20 and summer of 21, the numbers were, I mean, they were minuscule compared to what they are now. So you could think, yeah, they could play some outdoor shows in August in the States, but that doesn't seem to be the situation. Doesn't seem to be what's going to be happening. And I guess we just another year of looking forward to another year of no shows, rather.
Certainly touring is happening. The War on Drugs just announced, and I'm supposed to see them next month, they are moving forward. They did eliminate their opening act. They are taking special precautions, but they are planning on playing the shows. Jason Isbell has been touring for months now, except he just announced today he's COVID positive, so they canceled the next five shows. Really, from an economic standpoint, I think it is very challenging for Bruce with these big stadium shows in Europe. If four or five of them suddenly get wiped out and they can't be rescheduled, I don't know that the tour works economically for them. It's a real challenge. So let's just hope things get better.
We've been hoping that for 2 years now, but yeah, I also see that it would be a much more logistical nightmare to have shows scheduled, to have tickets sold, to have the whole itinerary set, and then all of a sudden, yeah, now we got to cancel these four or five shows, and then as you said, the reschedule and refunds and ticketing and that'd be more of a hassle for fans than I think not going through with it in the first place.
Well, I think on that, it's hard to say. Pearl Jam obviously has dates from March of 2020 that haven't been played yet. And in fact, they're supposed to be in May, but they haven't announced them, probably because of this situation. And I think fans are willing to put up with a lot. Now, the thing you have with a Pearl Jam tour that also applies with a Springsteen tour, you have a lot of traveling fans. So you also have to wonder if these acts want to put fans in that position. Fans could get trapped in quarantine in a strange country. And you're basically encouraging people to travel. So I would think that could also be a factor. But as we say at the moment, unfortunately, you know, we wait some more.
That's okay. We're used to waiting. Remember back in 89 and 90 and 91, hell.
That is true, but it's so different now. I wasn't trapped in my house in 1989.
That's true. That's true. But hey, this does mean, no tour does mean that the archive series is going to continue unabated, and we'll get 12 new releases this year, and we already got the first one.
And it was a damn good one.
Yes, it was. Really enjoying listening it the last few days. I mean, that the sound is phenomenal, and of course, it's a great set list. It really is. You got three tracks, if you include Stand On It as a track. You got an E Street debut of some 92 material. You got a reworked version of an E Street classic, well, album, or album classic anyway. And then you got that out of nowhere cover.
And I was at the show. I wrote the review for Backstreets, which was fun. This was a really cool night. And really, the release stands as a testament, because this is a show that nobody's really ever talked about from the reunion tour. It's in the middle of that run where Hartford took place, and then you had the debuts in Atlanta, and Vegas was there, and nobody ever really talked about Anaheim. And I made this point in my review. These 2 months of touring were certainly the best run of shows I've seen in the reunion era. Even as I remember it, they were on fire every night. And I think you feel the same way, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. They were at such a consistently high level, night after night after night. And you're right. This show did kind of get lost between Hartford and then Atlanta. And then, of course, the 10 nights at the Garden. And I come back to my point that this recording just shows how great they were, even at a show that did get overlooked. Yeah, it's a great show. Just because you didn't have a great recording of it before doesn't mean it wasn't great. Now, there was a pretty good IEM mix of it. But even the best IEM mixes are not going to, they're still going to pale in comparison to an official release.
I'll say it's more than just a recording, because, of course, this was a show I was at. Now, you and I saw a huge number of shows that spring. And until I went back and listened to the show when they released it on Friday, and also I'm prepping for the review, I did listen to the audience recording. From the moment they kick in here, with Take Them As They Come, I mean, this is a band that is just a driving force. And it really does stand. The songs that were played throughout the reunion tour here are just phenomenal. And then you get these unusual setlist choices that he was doing. Roll the Dice, which was obviously prepped for Vegas the next show, and the country version of No Surrender, which was only played a handful of times, and Racing the Street, which makes its first appearance from the reunion tour in the archive series, and then the unusual encores. The show really stands up as big. And it, as you were just saying, this is an every night they were just consistently great. And I'm not saying that that hasn't been the case at other points in the reunion era, but you listen to every aspect here, the Max's drumming and Clarence and Bruce's vocals. Let there not be any misunderstanding that the people who've claimed for years, listening mainly on tape, that Bruce's vocals on the reunion tour, that there was something wrong with them. That is shattered with this release, as well as the Garden releases.
Well, I never even thought that for a second. You know, we saw a bunch of shows on that tour, and I never once walked out of a show going, man, his voice didn't sound very good. No, it sounded freaking amazing every night. And I guess there's some basis for criticism of the twang during something like Thunder Road, but yeah, that's about it. And I was really, really digging Danny's contributions earlier today, especially on Take Them As They Come. That swirling organ in the left channel, just, man, he was on fire on that tour.
Yeah. And since it's Clarence's birthday, I mean, to point out the Roll of the Dice, which is augmented by an extended sax break in this first time that they were ever playing it. How good is that? I mean, you listen to it and you're just like, holy crap, this is amazing, amazing stuff. And the racing in the street also, the coda at the end. Mm-hmm. I've always felt the reunion tour versions of Racing in the Street were pretty much as good as any versions that there ever were. And there's just, this is just a show of highlights. And it, again, it just goes to show, this is a show that was never considered really a top shelf show. And if you're comparing it to the other shows that took place in those months, it nobody's going to say this is a better show than May 8th in Hartford. It was not. We both witnessed May 8th, and I, of course, witnessed this show. It was certainly not a better show than the accounts we've heard from Atlanta. There were shows at the Garden that I was there for the final six shows, certainly that were better than this show. But that doesn't matter, because this show, standing on its own, was freaking awesome.
Yeah, I think it's time that they go ahead and release every show that they have from those 2 months on tape, and we can listen to each one and really delve into the specifics as to which was better, which night was better. So,
well, but, sadly, you know, as you've already reported, they don't have Hartford and they don't have Atlanta. I don't know what else they have.
They don't have Vegas, so we're kind of.
Oh, they don't have Vegas either.
No, so I think this might be it, except for the Garden.
So that's good info. So basically, in May and June, and of course, including July 1st, which has already been released, you believe they don't have anything else except for Anaheim and the Garden. We know they don't have Hartford and Atlanta, and you just said they don't have Vegas. The only other show is Salt Lake City.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, well.
All right, that's not much, I guess, but.
Well, we're glad about this one.
Release all 10 nights of the Garden. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, can you confirm they have all 10 nights?
I don't know about that.
Okay, well, I just figured we'd get some news here.
I don't. Hey, I gave you something they don't have. Does that count?
Yes.
But I want to go back to your comment on Racing in the Street. It's not usually a song that you associate with thunderous drums from Max, but this one has it. It was such a. You're right. The coda is just breathtaking, and Max's drumming really stood out to me today. And yeah, beautiful version. And I'm thankful that it's finally been included from the reunion tour here.
That was a glaring thing to be missing, to be sure. And
well, you know, but on the other hand, they gave us a couple of incidents, a couple of serenades, so a couple of jungle lands. So it's kind of hard to complain too much there.
Now, the other thing to discuss in the show is the impromptu version of Gloria, which to this day, 22 years later, I still have no idea where it came from. At that point, very often after Land of Hope and Dreams, he would do his shtick with the crowd and would go into Ramrod. And certainly that was what we were expecting on this night. And suddenly he picked up his guitar and there was driving drums and they were playing them's Gloria.
Well, what was interesting was not only did they do the usual shtick, but then he went one more for Anaheim. And that's when you expect to hear the opening riff to Ramrod. But it went into the opening riff from Gloria. So, yeah, that was out of left field.
And it was big time fun. I remember it to this day. I mean, that was really a fun moment. And that's where the E Street Band shines, in these impromptu moments where they're playing a rock classic and you wouldn't expect to hear. And in many ways, it prefaces the sign era that would come up, even though this wasn't a request, as far as we know. But the one thing here was they were so tight. As we know, some of the requests were better than others in terms of the eventual performance. They were so tight. I mean, listen to the performance of Gloria here. It's totally out of control.
Well, I was going to say it was a lot more organic than the 2009 Stump the Band sign its stuff. You know, a lot of those were obviously forced. They were sign requests. And this one, it just came out of Bruce's psyche somewhere in Bruce's subconscious. He said, I'm doing Gloria, or maybe not even subconscious. And he just ripped into it. And man, that was fun. As you said, I mean, I wasn't there, but I was, had a big smile on my face listening to it in the car this morning.
Oh yeah. It's a great listen. And the Ramrod is fun to end the night. And again, just a great show for them to release, and hopefully there will be some more from the reunion tour. I my guess would be next one they'll go back to 99, you would think?
That would be my guess. I mean, they gotta hit the Jersey stand at some point.
Do we know if they have anything from Jersey?
I think they do. I don't know which nights. I don't know if they have all 15 or if they have one, or I don't know what they have. Well, I mean, but hell, if they recorded Anaheim and if they recorded Chicago, surely they did New Jersey.
I said to someone else the other day, if you assume anything in this world, all we have to do is point out that they didn't record his 50th birthday, a one-off performance at the Spectrum.
And well, that was a one-off performance and not 15 nights, so it's a little different.
That is true. But still, you would have thought that would have been recorded.
Well, yeah, but they had to, they basically had one day to move everything. Well, they had 2 days to move everything into the Spectrum, and then they had one day to move it out for the next night at the back at the other arena, whatever it was called.
First Union.
First Union, yeah. So, you know, I guess that one truck didn't get moved in those few days.
All right. Well, at least we have 925.99.
That's true. And hey, in all the songs that were all the unique songs done at the Spectrum show, they've been released. It's just not from this show, but from other ones.
They have. Are you talking they were released from the reunion tour? Because the one that comes to mind immediately is the Fever. That was certainly not released from the reunion tour.
No, it wasn't, but it was released in 2016 when it was also done in Philadelphia at the first show on September 7th, 2016.
That's true. So I'll give you that one.
Thank you.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
All right. Well, we have a guest tonight, and I think she's going to be very, very informative on what happened that second night of No Nukes when Bruce was turning 30. And with that, Flynn, would you like to introduce her?
Our guest tonight is Joyce Millman. She wrote the Backstreets.com review for the No Nukes film, and she's a longtime music and TV critic. And Joyce, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us, Joyce.
Yeah.
So you were lucky enough to be at one of the No Nuke shows.
Yes. I was the birthday show.
Okay, so that was the 22nd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did you, can you explain a bit of your fandom prior to those two shows?
I saw my first show early in the Darkness tour. So that was May of 78 in Boston.
Okay.
So, I mean, I knew who he was before then, because he got played a lot on Boston radio, like the first two albums. And then Born to Run came out, I knew it, but like, I don't know where my head was at. I wasn't really listening. I wasn't ready. But, I kind of missed the boat on the all the great early Bruce shows in Boston.
And
in college I started, everybody, all the kids from from Philly and Long Island and New York. And, you know, they were all really, you know, Bruce. So I started to pay attention. And by the time the Darkness tour came, I was ready. You know, I was primed. So that's where I came in. You know, Darkness 78, that was my, you know, that was the way in for me. And like that album, that's still my favorite Bruce album, and it's one of my favorite albums. And it just got me thinking about how to write about music in a meaningful way. So that kind of started, you know, I was still in college, and it kind of got me on a path to writing about music with that album. So yeah, I came in 78.
Okay, so you're already a big fan of After Darkness, and now you're getting to see No Nukes, which of course is taking place between tours. I read the Backstreets piece, and you really wrote about it beautifully. Can you give us a little color of that night, what it felt like to be there on September 22nd, 1979?
Well, I was with Holly Cara, and some other women that I really can't remember who, and I feel terrible. But, you know, we were all of us ready. There was a definite, you know, real buzz in that place because it, you know, he was going to go on last. The shows, you know, they were 5 hours long. So he was going to be on stage when it turned midnight, and it would be his birthday. So it was like, you know, the anticipation that something, you know, something big was going to happen, something cool. We didn't know what it was going to be, but oh boy, it's his birthday. So this is going to be a special show. And, you know, it was unfair to the other performers because this was a Bruce crowd. And it wasn't like, you know, people were sitting there politely listening to Gil Scott-Heron and Peter Tosh. And that's, I feel so bad about that now. But, you know, they were, it was, I don't want to say disrespectful, but people wanted to see Bruce. They were there for Bruce. It was, these shows were the only sellouts. So it was like, you know, and as the hours ticked by, I think he came on stage at 11:45, and we'd been there for hours, you know. It was crazy. Poor Tom Petty, I think he was the act to go on before Bruce.
He was not pleased, that is for sure.
He was not pleased. I mean, he shouldn't, and yeah, I don't blame him. I mean, it was just constant Bruce. So yeah, this was an audience. This was a Madison Square Garden filled with Bruce fans, just could not contain ourselves.
Can I back up a little bit? What kind of expectations did you have for the shows or the show, like prior to walking into the arena?
Well,
maybe you didn't have any. It's okay.
No. I won't lie to you. I wanted to see Bruce, and you know, yeah, I love Bonnie Raitt. I love Tom Petty, and you know, we listened. My group listened, you know, we were kind of into it, but we were there for Bruce. I wanted to see Bruce so badly. It had been so long. It had been a whole year. And it was his birthday, and I thought, he's going to blow the roof off. And, you know, I'm in New York for the first time. This is, you know, this is great. This is going to be so great. So that's where my head was at. That's what my expectation was, that it was going to be a wild night.
Well, I definitely think your expectations were met that night. And tell us a little more. It's 11:45. The wait is over. Bruce takes the stage. Set the scene for us.
We also had pretty crummy seats. We were side stage, like up in the balcony. So, you know, really, you know, we couldn't, and there were no, you know, big screens at the time. There were, you know, arenas, all the arenas have big screens now. There were no screens. So we couldn't really see his expressions unless he turned, you know, turned around to us, which was a bummer. But as it got going, and, you know, it was like, oh, okay, Prove It All Night. These are my favorite songs. And you know, it started to feel like, oh, this is going to be a, you know, a Darkness show again. But then it kind of took that swerve into the river. And first the birthday. Right. First it turned midnight. And that was weird.
You wrote about the cake incident. Must have seemed really strange.
It did seem strange because it just, this wasn't him. And, you know, this was just so out of left field that somebody hands him a cake and he throws it into the audience. And who knows where it landed? I mean, it probably landed on somebody, you know? And we were just kind of looking at each other like, oh, what is going on with him? And I don't think it, at the time we knew, and we still don't, but there were, you know, I read something recently that, you know, somebody who was there said, oh, he was having a really hard time with turning 30. So, you know, he was acting out a little, I think. But yeah, that was just, I can't even tell you how weird, it was a weird, disappointing kind of scene, you know, when he did that. He really seemed kind of bratty, and he isn't bratty. So that was like an odd side of him. But then he kind of shut down, you know, everybody wanted to sing happy birthday. And he just really wasn't having it and shut it down and then went into the river. And, you know, looking back on that, it's just mind blowing that it was like that was such like an almost uncontrolled scene. And then he just took control of it instantly with, you know, the harmonica comes out and he starts, you know, this song that nobody has heard before. It was just really, you know, it was bold of him. And it just, I think it shows now. At the time, I can't say that I really understood what was happening, but he really was, you know, showing that he really had the control of his arena crowd, you know. And I think that's something he had to, you know, to test, if he could control the, you know, this. And he did, because it was silent in there during the river. Considering how crazy people were, you know, all night, it was just silent, you know, just listening to the words of this song that was just so different from anything we've heard from him before. And it was stunning. It was, you know, it knocked the wind out of us to hear those lyrics.
So did that raise your expectations for the new album?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't know what I thought was going to happen with it. Was the whole album going to be, you know, this kind of, you know, this very deep folk stuff that he's sort of started to get into with Darkness. But then right after the river, he started Sherry Darling. So that, you know, that was the polar opposite. So we just had no idea like what was coming with the river. And, you know, we didn't know it was going to be, you know, as long as it is and all But it was just like, wow, he's kind of all over the map. This is good.
Well, you talked about the brattiness. Well, can we talk about the Lynn Goldsmith incident?
Yeah.
You said it was fortunately not included in the film. What do you recall from that?
It was ugly, you know. It was weird and ugly. And I mean, the concert was going all, you know, he had kind of gotten over that weirdness with the cake, and you know, he was blowing the roof off, and then all of a sudden he just goes down in the audience, and you know, I mean, everybody from where we were, we could actually, from our vantage point, we could see, you know, that he was, oh, he's pulling a woman up on stage. So we had like a really good view looking down on that. And we didn't know who it was. And I think people thought, oh, yeah, this is nice. He's bringing his girlfriend up or whatever. I think Lynn Goldsmith must have been turned toward us, because I remember her expression really clearly. He had her by the elbow or something. He pulls her on stage, and I think she had this like look on her face, like she was like sort of trying to smile, and she didn't know what was coming and making the best of it or whatever. And then when he said, "This is my ex-girlfriend," she tried to pull her arm away, and it was not good. It was ugly, and we kind of just went, "Ew, no."
Yeah.
Why? I'm glad that film of that has kind of, I guess, been buried in a hole or burned or destroyed or something.
They couldn't have put that in. I mean, some people were upset because it was documented, but sure. I just think, especially 40 years later, not only for him, but for her, I mean, it wouldn't have been appropriate.
Yes. And they did smooth it over and, you know, and so if they're past it, then why do we need to bring it up again? I get that where people are coming from that, oh, well, why, you know, for the sake of completeness, why is this out, you know, but it just, It really took away from the momentum of the moment of, you know, of the show. The film works because it's not in there, because it's just like you're building and building and building up to that amazing finish, you know. And I think it was during 2:45 that he did that. You know, you don't need it.
There also wouldn't have been context for it, really. I don't think most of the audience would have known exactly what was going on there. There's no defending his behavior, but if you think about it now, 40 years later, the guy was having a meltdown because he turned 30 and he felt like things were slipping away.
Isn't that funny?
Flynn just saw him the other night at 72.
72, yeah, like 30. Oh, I'm over the hill. But, you know, in the context of the times, I don't think younger people today really, you know, understand what that meant. But, you know, when you grew up during the 60s and the 70s, you know, it was 30 was like, forget it. That's it. Your life is over, which is ridiculous to think of now. But, you know, and he was a child of the 60s and 70s, and they were still, you know, that was still kind of in people's consciousness that 30 was the end. But it is funny now that, you know, 40 years later.
How did the film measure up to your memory? I know you touched upon that a bit in your Backstreets piece.
Well, I was really grateful to have that film because, you know, my memory, I mean, I've never kept a diary, so I didn't like come out of there and immediately write everything down. And there were, of course, no cell phones or anything to document it. So it was just in my memory, which, you know, your memory fades. So when I saw the film, it pieces of that night started to come back to me. So I was really grateful to have that, you know, to just be able to watch that, you know, again. And it kind of like transported me back to where, you know, where I was in my life at that point. Like, oh, I get to see this again from, you know, this perspective where I'm not like overwhelmed in the moment. I can just watch it and really see what happened. So it just, it gave those memories back to me. And I'm sure a lot, it did that for a lot of people.
I thought what you wrote was very poignant at the end of the piece about how it was really sort of an emotional jumble to watch. Of course, you were with Holly, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And then there on the screen, Danny is gone and Clarence is gone. When I watched it for the first time, that really struck me to see Clarence and Danny in at their biggest moments at, you know, as 30-year-olds. I think Clarence was a little bit older because Bruce was 30, so he would have been in his late 30s. But to see them with the force and the entire band, it's really a wonder to see.
They were an overwhelming band. I think they were playing song. When you look back at those, that era, those older, you know, shows, the tempos are so much faster on the songs, you know, but they were really jamming them out. And it was like, I said this, I think I wrote about seeing Bruce at the Garden from at the Boston Garden on the Darkness tour from down front. It's like standing in the middle of a hurricane. I mean, it is just overwhelming. To see the musicianship like up close, but also just the emotion and the they were just so attuned as a unit. It's just amazing. And you forget how badass Clarence, you know, in his prime and his, you know, those suits that he had on in you know, both nights of the Muse show. And you see a little bit of that splendor, you know, like the white suit and the red one and the hat. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to have that, you know, to be able to see that again, that band in its prime.
Now, you did say you didn't document it, or there wasn't much documentation going on. But you did write a review.
I wrote a review for it was a free music paper that you used to get at the Strawberries Music, you know, store. And it was I reviewed it, and my little 22-year-old self reviewed that for this free music rag. So that's kind of, I guess I did document it. Yeah.
There's a link to it from the Backstreets, yeah. Or your Backstreets piece to your WordPress.com site.
Yeah. The writing's not great, but you know, what can I say? I was a kid, but yeah, when I went back and read it, I was really surprised at how much information I did manage to get in there, considering that I was, you know, I was out of my mind, you know, watching Bruce and trying to take notes, but really up there screaming, you know.
Well, we appreciate you coming on and sharing with us. You know, Hal and I are a little bit too young to have seen him in 79. So we love hearing directly from people who were there.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Glad I could share it with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Joyce. We really do appreciate it.
Again, that was Joyce Millman. She wrote the review of the No Nukes film for the Backstreet's website, and she's a writer and reporter by trade. And it's always good to get additional insight into the show, especially we hadn't talked about the Lynn Goldsmith incident yet.
That is 100% true. And just so funny to think about, as I was saying when Joyce was on, that he was melting down like that because he was turning 30. I'd love it. We'll, of course, never hear from him on that topic for sure. But it would be really fascinating to know what he thinks about that now, considering he's 72 and still rocking.
Yeah, that would be a good question to ask him. I mean, he's going to go until the day drops, obviously.
Yeah. So turning 30 really wasn't that big of a deal after all.
No, and we should all remember that. Really, any age is like that.
So, and do we have a special guest? Have you arranged someone for us tonight?
Yes, we do. We found someone who...
Did you have to look very far?
I did not have to look very far. I just had to look across the room. Ken Rosenthal is not the only person we're going to talk to about No Nukes being their first show. We also have Claudine.
Claudine, your lovely wife, who I met on August 4th, 1992 at a Springsteen show.
At the Meadowlands.
That is correct.
Now, going back to the No Nuke shows, there were two nights. Claudine, do you remember which night you attended?
I do. I went to the first night, which was the first night of Rosh Hashanah.
So was that a problem for you, the fact that it was the first night of Rosh Hashanah?
It was a major problem for me. I grew up with parents who were Holocaust survivors, and Rosh Hashanah was a very big holiday. And my mom's side of the family was more Orthodox than we were. And when I told her that I had tickets for a concert that night, she said, "There is no way in hell I am going." So I had to think quickly. And I said to my mom, I changed Bruce's name a little bit. And I said, "Mom, his name is Bruce Springsteen. He's German. He's Jewish. If his mother's letting him play, how could you not let me go?" And she looked at me a little bit dumbfounded, and she couldn't say no. She said, "Okay, go. Just don't tell your aunts where you are." I said, "Okay." And off I went. And it changed my life. It was the first show that I saw. It made me want more and more. And I couldn't stop. And because of this night on one of the highest holy Jewish holidays, I've met some of my best friends, my husband.
And I've had a podcast host.
Who's a podcast host? And
there are two of us, yes.
Yes. And you, I met you back in 92, which was another monumental night for me. And of course, for you, since we've spoken to each other every single day since then, bar none. So I'm grateful to Bruce for bringing my life together like this, because it would have never happened.
Well, it's a wonderful thing. And when you went back home after this, and you've obviously gone out on Rosh Hashanah, when you went back home, what were you saying to yourself? Just beyond, "I got to see more of that."
I never felt so energized, so involved in a show, that I just felt that I needed to see this again. And once the River Tour started, it just exploded, and I kept going. And I've met tons of people along the way, and my life changed. It totally went a different turn. My friends were not into Bruce. They were into disco. I hated it. My other friends were into heavy metal. So I kind of made a niche for myself and let this journey take me where it took me today. And 40 years later, I'm still doing the same thing and loving every minute of it.
And we hope to do it again at some point in the future.
That is true.
It is interesting to think about how much our lives have been affected or influenced by this one man and his music. And I want to know if he understands what he has done in that regard for so many people. And I mean, obviously me included, and the two of you. It's just, if there's one thing we want to tell him, is how much that his art, his career has affected us.
It's interesting, because I do think he probably knows it. My guess is he tries not to think about it regularly, only because it is such a sort of a mind-blowing thing to think that you could be the vector to all these people being friends and having relationships. And it's really an amazing thing. If you think about it, even think of the Spring Nuts group and all those people, and we know that they know about that group. It would be interesting to get his thoughts on that. But my guess is on a day-to-day basis, that's not really something that's on his mind.
Yeah, probably not. That'd be kind of overwhelming to think that if I hadn't written Born to Run, then this kid over here never would have been born. There is that situation in a number of families.
Definitely. Claudine, do you have anything else you'd like to add for the audience this first time that you're on?
It's been a wonderful experience, and maybe one day I'll do it again.
I think everyone would welcome that.
What, appearing on the podcast or seeing Bruce in concert?
Yes, both.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time out to join us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, that was a blast. Thanks, Claudine.
Thanks, Hal.
Well, that was fun. It's not every day we get to have my wife come on and talk about her Bruce experiences. We've been looking for a chance to have her on in some capacity and to have her talk about her first show. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really was. And I'm glad we did that. And just trying to be hopeful here, maybe the three of us will see a show together sometime soon.
I'm not really sure soon would be the right word at this point. No, but
it was what came to mind. I'm trying to be hopeful here.
For what are we without hope in our hearts?
I think that's now two episodes that you've used that.
Well, that's right, okay. Well, we need it. We need it.
Yes. All right. Well, let's get to the end here. I think that completes our episode pretty damn well. So I'll just go to our spiel. None But the Bravest, presentation of Bull Market Entertainment and a part of Evergreen Podcasts. If you want to reach out and talk to us, find us on Twitter at NBTB Podcast and on the web, we're at NoneButTheBravePodcast.com.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McClain saying thanks for listening. And thanks to our guests tonight, Joyce Millman and my lovely wife, Claudine Gruen. And we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.